Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This episode, as always, is presented by our friends over at SeatGeek. Playoffs kick off over the weekend. Major League Baseball is in full swing. SeatGeek has got you covered on the tickets to all of these games and more. Download the SeatGeek app or go to SeatGeek.com. Buy some tickets to something, but before you go to checkout, little promo code box. Do me a favor, enter in the promo code Can We Please Talk. You're going to get $20 off of that first purchase. Head to SeatGeek.com or download the SeatGeek app today. Hey, everybody. Welcome into an all-new episode of Can We Please Talk podcast. As always, I'm Mike Leon.
And I'm Nick Staveri.
On the program today, Nick, tell me if this checks out. It's a rhetorical question, so you don't have to answer. If you are president of the United States and you want to kill your political rival, apparently you may be able to. Nick and I are going to weigh in on last week's oral arguments presented to the Supreme Court by former President Trump's attorney in the claim that the president should be immune from committing crimes because he did them as official acts while president of the United States. More on that in just a bit. If you didn't hear any of the Supreme Court last week hearing the immunity case, I'm going to play some sound. It's pretty chilling, even for some of the stuff that's been playing out in news. I wanted to devote some space to that in our first segment. Plus, later on the program, investigative reporter for the Epoch Times, Nan Suess, joins the podcast to discuss the history and relationship between China and the U.S. You know, we have committees in Congress that are talking about the dangers of China, this superpower rival of ours, why the CCP is making inroads in Western media and businesses and more, why Taiwan is so crucial to defending it. Nan's going to break it all down in our final segment in just a bit. A really good interview that we did with Nan Suess over at the Epoch Times, and a lot of interesting stuff that I learned about the relationship between China and Taiwan, Xi Jinping's activities on some of these committees, the way China conducts businesses, and we even talk about the TikTok legislation too and why that was imperative to pass. So great interview coming up right after Nick and I talk about this. Nick, I say hello to you, buddy. How's everything going your way before we get into this hearing? Did you watch any of this hearing yesterday? Because I know the networks were covering all of this Supreme Court immunity. Obviously, the former president's in court for the New York trial that's happening, but that's not televised. The Supreme Court is never televised, but they do allow audio recordings in there. So there was a lot of networks grabbing audio from there. And then, you know, they blow it out with five or six legal analysts. You don't need seven people's opinion networks, just an FYI. You can do with like two, go to break, you know, an hour there, and then bring on two new ones. Maybe break it up. You don't have to put seven people on a panel. So, Nick, what'd you make of, did you watch any of it? Let's start there. And how are you doing?
No, I haven't watched any of it. I mean, I've been reading it in the papers, just to get the sense of what's going on. I'm troubled by this idea that we're talking about immunity. You know, previously, the biggest immunity conversation we've been having in this country has been about qualified immunity as it relates to police officers. And now we've moved into this conversation of what is the president immune from? And what I'm struggling here is, at least the way I understood the role when I was in high school and, you know, taking your history classes and such. And this was a public servant's role. This is no different than a person who runs for Congress, person who is the mayor of my town. Obviously, I mean, I'm being a little facetious with that last one, but the idea that a person is duly elected and then they represent a group of people. In this case, this is the role of the president of the United States. So when we're having this conversation of what is a person immune from, I find it a little chilling, because that seems to be the kind of argument you would see in a totalitarian regime, where we're trying to figure out what you can find this person guilty of and what this person is, quote unquote, immune from. I hear immunity from accountability, from legislation, from punishment. And to me, that sounds like something you would hear in North Korea.
You know, you're going to, well, first off, I mean, I want people to make their own conclusions on this. But, I just thought this hearing last week, I was fascinated by it. And all the clips have been making the social rounds, because some of the way the questions were asked by the justices, both conservative and liberal, obviously appointed, some of the way they asked the questions to Trump's attorney and obviously to special counsel Jack Smith's attorney was pretty interesting to me. And I want to devote in our first segment here, for people that did not watch this hearing or don't know what it's about, it's obviously they're talking about the former president, obviously was charged in D.C. by Jack Smith and special counsel there with respect to what happened on January 6th. He's charged with obstruction of an official proceeding. A bunch of other charges that are a part of that as well, trying to defraud the United States, et cetera. But the biggest argument the Trump team has made, and they've made it to lower courts and the Court of Appeals, and all of them have rejected the argument. Now it's in front of the Supreme Court. The argument that they have been making, it's some novel legal question of whether a former president can be prosecuted for what they're saying is official acts that take place in office. So an official act. There is nothing that says something is an official act. But like to Nick's point, if a president does something while he's president, can we consider it an official act as office of the president, or do we consider it a personal act? So this was kind of like the question back and forth, because the Department of Justice has a longstanding memo that they don't indict sitting presidents for crimes. They don't have anything, obviously, for former presidents. And when January 6th happened, Trump was still president until January 21st, right? So he was still president for 2 weeks. So the questions and scenarios, these hypotheticals that came up, I want to take them each one by one, Nick, and we're going to react off of them. So this is the first one that we're going to play here, because like I said, both liberal and conservative justices were bashing Trump's attorney, or at least giving him some hypotheticals that he couldn't get his way out of a paper bag with some of these. So I want you to take a listen to the first one. This is Justice Sotomayor asking the question I asked at the top of this show. Hey, can I kill my political rival? Is that an official act as president? Take a listen.
If the president decides that his rival is a corrupt person and he orders the military or orders someone to assassinate him, is that within his official acts that for which he can get immunity?
It would depend on the hypothetical, but we can see that could well be an official act.
It could. And why? Because he's doing it for personal reasons. He's not doing it like President Obama is alleged to have done it, to protect the country from a terrorist. He's doing it for personal gain. And isn't that the nature of the allegations here, that he's not doing these acts in furtherance of an official responsibility, he's doing it for personal gain.
I agree with that characterization of the indictment, and that confirms immunity, because the characterization is that there's a series of official acts that were done for an
unlawful. No, because immunity says even if you did it for personal gain, we won't hold you responsible.
So, you know, that's John Sauer, who's the president's attorney right there. And you heard him kind of say, first off, just for me, Nick, he says, you know, I don't agree with like the scenario. I'd have to understand what the hypothetical is. Dude, this is not rocket science. Like I gave you a scenario. Right now, if President Biden ordered for the military to kill former President Trump right now, you're telling me that we should not prosecute President Biden because it's an official act that he is conducting as current president of the United States, because he deems a former President Trump as a threat, whatever it is. That's the scenario that they're playing out in front of the court. Nick, am I taking crazy pills here, to quote Mugatu from Zoolander? Give me your thoughts on just that first one, because there's a couple other instances and I don't want to dive too much into the legal jargon, but just that scenario right there on its face, what'd you make of it?
Yeah, I'm struggling with why this seems so clear as it's played out in this conversation between you and I, and obviously our listeners listening in. You know, I thought the question from the justice was pretty straightforward. Like, she gave a particular scenario, and you know what we got back, and we often get in these cases, is just legal jargony gobbledygook from the attorney. So, because that seemed like a real long way of saying, well, yes, that would be okay. And, you know, it goes back to what I was saying at the start, which is, you know, if we're talking about immunity, and I appreciate you mentioning, you know, the difference between personal and professional, and that's where it gets really interesting, is that the justice is making the argument that a decision to kill your political rival would be a personal decision. But, like, this is where my head hurts, is that, you know, we're trying to mince words here. Like, did we really walk into a situation where we have someone who may have committed a crime, but that crime is being argued as because that was done for professional reasons, it's not really a crime. And what scares me with all this is, if you open the door to this idea that a person who sits in that Oval Office can be immune from virtually anything, first off, it totally justifies what I said in terms of why Trump's running, is for this reason, that before completely gets washed away if he, you know, if this happens. Which, by the way, for anyone who's ever seen the movie Dogma, it's a little like the angels just trying to get through the doors to the church, because, you know, just wax on, wax off. Go see the movie. It's a good one. This confirms the suspicions for folks like me about Trump's intent. And the answer is simple. Seeking immunity for potential crimes he committed previously is a way of really just washing his hands, or his legal team washing of his hands, of things that he may have well done.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more of this hearing, because again, the scenarios at play, a bunch of different questions. Amy Comey Barrett, they, you know, obviously they took a couple minutes, turns, each of them went back and forth. But listen to what Amy Comey Barrett asked scenario-wise, and what John Sauer, again, and I've said this on Twitter, this guy has to buy into this. I mean, he's getting paid to do this. But you can hear it in his voice that he doesn't necessarily agree with some of this. Just take a listen to the way he answers this question.
You concede that private acts don't get immunity.
We do.
Okay. So in the special counsel's brief on pages 46 and 47, he urges us, even if we were to decide or assume that there was some sort of immunity for official acts, that there were sufficient private acts in the indictment for the case to go back and the trial to begin immediately. And I want to know if you agree or disagree about the characterization of these acts as private. Petitioner turned to a private attorney who was willing to spread knowingly false claims of election fraud to spearhead his challenges to the election results. Private?
As alleged. I mean, we dispute the allegation, but sounds private to me.
Sounds private. Petitioner conspired with another private attorney who caused the filing in court of a verification signed by petitioner that contained false allegations to support a challenge.
Also sounds private.
Three private actors, two attorneys, including those mentioned above, and a political consultant helped implement a plan to submit fraudulent slates of presidential electors to obstruct the certification proceeding, and petitioner and a co-conspirator attorney directed that effort.
You read it quickly. I believe that's private. I don't want to.
So those acts you would not dispute. Those were private, and you wouldn't raise a claim that they were official.
As characterized, what we would say, Your Honor, if I may, what we would say as official is things like meeting with the Department of Justice to deliberate about who's going to be the acting Attorney General of the United States.
Sure.
Communicating with the American public, communicating with Congress about matters of enormous.
Thank you.
Sir.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you agree, buddy, that these are, and again, Amy Comey Barrett. Okay, Nick, Amy Comey Barrett read out for this guy charges that are playing out in other states, like in Georgia with co-conspirators being charged, like the Michigan stuff that's playing out now with fake electors and a scheme to send fake electors to Washington, D.C. to say that, you know, that Michigan was in favor of Republican nominee Donald Trump. So she read him out scenarios. Again, without taking out, you know, the current charges right now across the different jurisdictions, she read for him scenarios that are playing out right now in other states. And he said those would be private acts. And you heard in his answer, I don't agree with the characterization. Well, but then your answer, long-winded, you gave me word salad. And then you said, I agree, these are private acts. So you agree that the president would be acting in his own self-interest, and it's not an official act, as you know what he said, appointing a department head. Yeah, that's an official act. You have to, you know, declare somebody for attorney general, and then they have to go through the process of being confirmed. What'd you make of that exchange there, and how Amy Comey Barrett is now on Team Justice here? What'd you make of that?
I mean, I guess on a certain level that makes sense about what you just said about Justice Barrett, but yeah, that kind of is just the Trump team basically being asked to show their butt. I'll use the nicer word here. You know, all those things she listed are things that, yeah, these are done for the benefit of a private citizen. So none of these would qualify for immunity. And you could see that, you know, clearly Sauer, who desperately sounded like he was in need of a glass of water at that point, was just basically having to acquiesce. I don't know. And it is very telling because a more conservative justice, and I don't know what conservatism or liberalism means in this case in terms of whether it means being sympathetic to the former president, or is it about a strict adherence to the Constitution or more of a liberal view of it? I have no idea, but that seemed like similar to Justice Sotomayor asking to really sort of zero in on the absurdity of the claim of the immunity argument.
This is going to be interesting no matter how much you slice it, but the biggest thing is going to be that the Supreme Court goes for summer break in June, towards the end of June. So they need to decide on this case. So that way it can be decided whether or not Jack Smith's charges on the Washington, D.C. January 6th stuff will actually make it to a trial before the election. Experts have said we're not going to get a trial in that this year. The Supreme Court's moving at a glacial pace. And this is part of it. Why? Because the Trump team is putting forth arguments like this in the lower courts, and it makes its way finally to the Supreme Court to listen to oral arguments about this. So we won't get an answer for any of this, but I wanted to talk about this because it is wild to me that there's a lawyer out there making a claim in front of our highest court in the land that you can kill your political rival because it's an official act being conducted as office of the president of the United States. If that's not wild, folks, I don't know what Nick and I are doing wrong. I don't know what, maybe John Sauer has convinced some people right now that are listening to this episode. I can't believe he has, but we'll continue. Oh, go ahead, Nick. One more thing.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because the Trump team has been so adamant about trying to delay these trials, to not have a decision made, you know, before the election bodes well for them. But the interesting thing is this exchange you and I just had about these clips. Again, if the Democrats were smart, and in terms of messaging, they often are not, this would be perfect to play in a campaign ad. This is a perfect thing to even bring up in a debate. So this may potentially backfire on the Trump team that the more legal cases you have out there that do not have a decision in favor of him or against, this information is public knowledge now. And this is the kind of thing that gets put out there that as a voter, my takeaway from this is that Trump has a lawyer out there that thinks that he could justify the president potentially killing a political opponent, which, listen, I'm just a podcast co-host and a darn good one, if I may add. I would have to be worried, right? You too. If we do a show that is anti the president who happens to be Trump, do we get viewed
as a potential threat. And then like, I look out the window, like the old woman in Poltergeist, when the drone comes striking through.
That's right. That's very well said. All right, we leave it there. When we come back after the break, my interview with Nan Su from the Epoch Times, everything about China and the U.S.'s relationship. Why are there subcommittees popping up to talk about the dangers of a superpower like China? Find out from Nan when we come back after the break.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Nick, today's episode is presented, as always, by our friends over at Fresh Roasted Coffee. Since 2009, their passion has always been bringing you gourmet coffees from all over the world, roasted fresh to order. I got my coffee snob here, Nick Saveri. Nick, tell these people, coffee snob it up here. Tell these people why Fresh Roasted Coffee is so good and why they're the official sponsor of Can We Please Talk?
You know, often the best cup of coffee that you're ever going to have is the one you can make from home. And you need good quality coffee to do that. And that's what Fresh Roasted Coffee offers. You know, between single origin, between blends, flavors, anything on the coffee spectrum they've got. But more importantly, and I can't stress this enough, often when you purchase coffee, you don't know where to start. I mean, there's so many different varieties, so many different opportunities, so many different things you could choose from. And Fresh Roasted Coffee just gives you a very simple questionnaire and just says, hey, figure out what your coffee cup is. Figure out what blend works for you. I've gotten some single origin recommendations, so has Mike, and that's influenced everything. And what they recommend, you can get in a Keurig cup, the way Mike takes it. You can take it in the way I do it, which is typically through a French press, or you can get it for a percolator. Whatever coffee machine you've got, they've got you covered. But more importantly, just a huge variety and a way to learn more about coffee itself.
And all of this is available at freshroastedcoffee.com on their site. One cup is all it takes to fall in love with Fresh Roasted Coffee, but you get a discount for being a listener of Can We Please Talk. Enter in the promo code Can We Please Get 20 to get 20% off your first purchase. Head to freshroastedcoffee.com today. All right, kind enough to give us a couple minutes here to talk about the Communist Party of China. We've been talking about it here on the show, the dangers of China and the U.S.'s relationship, or maybe lack thereof, with China. We're going to get into some of that in just a second with a reporter over at the Epoch Times, Nan Su, joining us here on the podcast. Nan, Mike, Leon, thank you so much for hopping on the program.
Oh, Michael, thank you for having me today.
You know, let's start at a high level here, because there's a lot to get to, and there was some recent legislation. I was telling you this off air about, you know, with TikTok, obviously a Chinese-owned company with ByteDance and the influence there from the CCP with respect to that app. So let's just start at a 30,000-foot overview, which we like to do here on this show. Tell us a little bit about what you've been covering with respect to the Communist Party of China and their influence, you know, around the world and specifically here in the United States.
Well, the Chinese communist regime has been in the last 20, almost 25 years after we allowed China to join WTO, they have been in every way infiltrated into the Western world, especially the United States, because in the minds of the Chinese Communist Party, the United States is always the number one enemy of the communist regime, because, you know, the entire regime is based on an ideology that's totally against the freedom. Now, specifically in the, you know, the most dangerous part was in the last 20, some years, they have been getting, you know, not only the jobs, you know, industries, consumer markets, investments, technologies from the United States, but they have been, you know, getting those for their military purpose, specifically ever since 2015, the Chinese Communist regime, you know, they started the effort of establishing a so-called military and civil fusion program. Now, under the Central Commission of Chinese Communist Regime's military, there is a committee named Military and Civil Fusion Program. And guess who is the director of the committee? It's Communist leader Xi Jinping himself. That just tells you how important that committee is. What they have done is they come to the Western world, like United States. They will send their universities, research institutions, commercial corporations, and all kind of other organizations. They will come to the Western world, come to United States under the name of exchange, like academic exchange. They will get the technologies, then they will go back to give to their military. Now, keep in mind, we are living in the age that's very much different than, you know, what how things used to be in the 60s and 70s. You know, in those times, that the military, the U.S. military actually has a very advanced technology. And then later, you know, we use that for the commercial purpose to benefit our society. But nowadays, it's totally different than the most advanced technology. They are owned by like Microsoft, Google, like NVIDIA, right? They are commercial corporations. So that's how the Chinese Communist regime, they are, you know, they're taking the advantage. They reach out to those organizations directly, including our universities. They will get their technology. They will give to their military for their military purpose, so they can get ahead of our technology for our military. So that's how they're trying to do the handle the whole things to catch up and, you know, to increase their power.
I want to shift because there's a lot of different directions we can go off of this, but Congress just recently passed funding. We saw that happened this past week. Nick and I were covering it, my co-host on the show here. We were covering this about the foreign aid package, $95 billion, about $68 billion of it is going to go to Ukraine. And obviously then the war that's happening in Gaza with Israel. So money's going to go to that. But there was about $8.1 billion appropriated that's going to be for the Indo-Pacific and specifically will help the U.S. with its defense in case China were to invade Taiwan. And this is something we've talked to military analysts about. And I would love for you, because I know you've done some recent articles around this, specifically around the relationship. So can you kind of, again, at a 30,000 foot overview, explain why China wants Taiwan back? Can you kind of explain that to us and why it's instrumental for the U.S. or Western world and the countries that are in the Indo-Pacific to protect Taiwan from being invaded by China?
Well, Taiwan is important to the United States, to the Western world, and to the entire Indo-Pacific region's stability and peace. Now, keep in mind that the core security strategy of United States right now is called the Indo-Pacific strategy, which deal with the region that extended from nations around Indian Ocean all the way to the other side of the Pacific. You know, that includes the entire American continent. Now, this strategy called this region, you know what the name they call it? They call it the entire world's center of gravity. Why? Because this is the region that actually encompasses half of the world's total population and two-thirds of the entire world's economy by GDP. Now, China is the biggest threat to this world's center of gravity if China invaded Taiwan. Now, why Taiwan is so important? Now, the Chinese Communist regime always say, you know, the way they want to, you know, reunify Taiwan. But that's a big lie. It's a big lie. The Taiwan, you know, the island nation has never belonged to the Chinese communist regime never belongs to the so-called People's Republic of China, never been part of it. Now, 1895, the Qing Dynasty, the island has been ruled by Spanish Empire, Dutch Empire since 18, and then later Qing Dynasty in China. But in 1895, Qing Dynasty, after loss of war to Japan, gave the island to Japan until 1945. It was U.S. military took the island back from Japan. Okay, that's very interesting, right? U.S. military took the island back from Japan's hand and occupied the island until 1954. Now, and then in 1954, the U.S. government signed a treaty with Taiwan's government, and it's a mutual defense treaty. That was the point the U.S. government basically recognized Taiwan. It's a part of Taiwan's government, which is the formal name of it is called Republic of China. So you have a Republic of China in Taiwan and People's Republic of China in China. So that's, so you see the entire history. Taiwan never belonged to China, the People's Republic of China, the Communist China. So the Communist China say they want to reunify Taiwan. That's a big lie. That's not Taiwan. The island is not really what they are going after. But what they're really going after is South China Sea. Now, South China Sea, it's like a little corridor running north and south. And then Taiwan is on the northern end of that corridor. Now, it's like a little cap. You can keep the corridor open or closed. If China controls Taiwan, then you will have dominant control of South China Sea. Now, Chinese communist regime has started building man-made islands in South China Sea in 2013. What they have done is they dump a massive amount of concrete to reefs in the South China Sea. Now, reef is something when you have high tide, it's below water. When you have a low tide, it's above water. Now, based on the international law, no country can claim the sovereignty of a reef, but however, you can claim sovereignty of islands as well as 12 miles of territory water from the coastal line of the island, right? Now, what they have done is they make a reef become islands, then they will go ahead, move forward to claim the sovereignty of those islands. Back in 2015, Chinese communist leader Xi Jinping promised President Obama that China will never militarize those man-made islands. But however, so far, they have, until now, they have fully militarized the 3 out of 7 man-made islands. So now, however, those small man-made islands are not significant enough for China to have dominant control of South China Sea. But if they take over Taiwan, things will be totally different. They will have dominant control of South China Sea. And once the Chinese regime leader have the dominant control of South China Sea, they will be able to do a few things. Huge impact to the entire Indo-Pacific region. Number one, they will be the Chinese communist regime will be able to choke the economic lifeline of Japan. Now, Japan is the world's fourth largest economy, used to be the third. Last year, Germany, little bit higher than Japan, so now it's number four, but it's the most important ally of United States in the region. But that, our Japanese friend have some fatal weakness, I would say, because it's an island nation. Most of the resources and economy, one third of the economy really depending on trade, the transportation line, most of those resources need to go through South China Sea to come in. That's number one. Number two, China will have a lot more say on the global economy. Why? Because every year you have about 10 trillion global trade, and close to 40% of that 10 trillion need to go through South China Sea. And number three, if the regime controls South China Sea, they will have a dominant influence to the Southeast Asian countries. And why are those countries so important? Because right now, you know, the U.S. corporations, the Western corporations are relocated their supply chain out of China because of the escalating geopolitical risk, right? But once they get out of China, guess where they're going? You know, besides, some of them will land to India, but most of them will go to Southeast Asian nations. And China doesn't want to let go their control of our supply chain. That's why they're going after the South China Sea. And also, if China controls South China Sea, the Chinese communist regime, there will be nobody. There'll be nobody there to stop the regime from moving further down south to threaten another very important ally of the United States, that's Australia. So, and, or, you know, besides all that, you know, if Chinese communist regime controls Taiwan, they will also gain the access to the entire Western Pacific region. You know, after, you know, once they enter it, the next thing is, you know, Hawaii, right? So it's completely coming to the United States. It's a huge security concern to the United States. And that's why, you know, the Chinese communist regime is going after Taiwan.
You know, this is why we have subject matter experts on the show to kind of explain some of this stuff, because as you were talking there, you know, you can't help but notice the parallels between what Russia and Vladimir Putin is doing with Ukraine and the fear of him going further west to Poland and then going to other NATO countries, Finland, that are all on the border. And you kind of are mentioning some of that, of what China's aggression could do. I'm curious from your perspective, as you've been reporting on this and you've been covering this, we recently had Representative Seth Moulton on the program, and he's on a very, you know, damning committee that's in the House. It's a select committee on strategic competition between the U.S. and the Chinese Communist Party. And like their big mission, as I was reading about the committee earlier today, it's, and I want to read it for you here, because, and I want to ask you a follow up on it. They are working on a bipartisan nature, Republicans and Democrats, to build consensus on the threat posed by the Chinese Communist Party and develop a plan of action to defend the American people, our economy, and our values. So that's a subcommittee right now working in Congress diligently on this. What do you make of the U.S.'s response to all of this? China's, I want to call it like pseudo-aggression, because we saw at that recent meetup between Xi and President Biden in San Francisco. Afterwards, President Biden said he is a dictator. And if you remember in the video, Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, was kind of shaking his head. You don't want to say that because you don't want to say it out loud, because I got to go deal with my counterpart over there in China. So what do you make of the way the U.S. has been responding, not only the President of the United States, the Biden administration, but now what you're seeing in Congress, where there's this bipartisan committee to talk about the dangers of the Communist Party of China?
Well, all I can say is that we're too slow. We are too slow dealing with the threat. We have been, you know, making the entire China policy in the past almost a half century with a kind of a wishful thinking. If we trying to, you know, make China become richer, one day, you know, the Beijing's leaders, they wake up in the morning, they will make China become a part of a democratic world. That's a wishful thinking. It's totally fail. But, you know, along with that, you know, more than 20 years of, you know, wishful thinking, you know, based China policy, see, at the same time, we're still thinking, you know, the rosy picture of the future of China to us, you know, the Chinese communist regime become the biggest threat of the entire human history. Now, keeping in mind, I call it the biggest threat to the peace and freedom in the entire history of mankind. Now, I often challenge people to make five different aspects of comparison yourself. You pick any other regime in the human history, in your mind, within your knowledge base, you make a comparison between that regime and the Chinese communist regime today, you know, in the five years back, economic power, military power, the technology it possessed already, and a total population, as well as the history of killing its own people, killing Chinese people. Now, there's nobody make a more threat to the global peace and humanity, I would say, in the entire human's history, more than the communist regime in China today. So we are really still, I think we are really way behind that what we should have done.
Well, you know, I want to stay on that because moving faster, something else that Congress did, you and I were talking about this off air recently, and it's around, obviously, there's a big election coming up here in the U.S. This November, and there's always misinformation, disinformation that gets spread out there. Social media platforms are at a core center of this. And we saw recently in Congress, there was an attempt first a couple months ago to pass some legislation around banning the use of TikTok. TikTok is owned by ByteDance, which is a Chinese-based company. And there's been some allegations that it is obviously owned by the Chinese Communist Party, or at least they're able to share all of the data and privacy information that they get from that application to the Chinese Communist Party. So I want to get from your perspective, as you're reporting on this and covering this for so long, what do you make of Congress's attempts right now, specifically around banning an app that could be, or at least appears to be, foreign influenced by what you're calling as the biggest threat, you know, that we're all facing here on this planet, the country of China? We're facing this threat. And here is an app that there's been some pushback from some on the left. There's some pushback, very little, from some on the right, but most are unified that TikTok should not be allowed in the U.S. And it has a different interface in China versus in other countries. And so they point to that. The data collections, what do you make of the bill overall and its attempts to stop the Chinese Communist Party from accessing foreign data of customers?
Well, I would say, you know, considering the data security, it's only one aspect of the effort. Now, I'll give you an example. Back in January 13th of this year, Taiwan has a presidential election. Now, before Taiwan's election, you know, there's a huge, it's a tremendous propaganda effort made by the Chinese Communist regime. You know, they have their preferred candidates, because if those candidates are elected, it will be much softer, you know, when it comes to the policy to the communist regime in China. And then there are candidates they are strongly against, so they have a huge propaganda war. You know, in Taiwan's society, spreading this information and rumors and painting an image that if you elect the strong candidate against the communist regime, you are choosing a war. If you elect those candidates that's more friendly to the regime, then you choose a peace, right? And guess who is the biggest player of the propaganda battle? TikTok. So, you know, we have a presidential election coming too. I mean, you know, we just recently have an FBI report that the Chinese Communist regime trying to infiltrate into the U.S. media and the Twitter, into Facebook. You know, they have a bunch of propaganda personal platforms set up there, and then there's a bunch of other, you know, personal platforms that connected to expand their message. And, you know, they're doing the same thing here in the United States. And if you are a congressional candidate, you want to take a strong policy against the communist regime, they will spread disinformation or negative messages against these candidates. Or if they think you are going to be more friendly to the regime, they will prepare the good messages for you. So they are doing the same thing here. And if we don't learn from whatever happened to Taiwan's election back in January that took place in Taiwan, then, you know, our presidential election may be impacted by, you know, allowing TikTok, that kind of a propaganda machine of the communist regime, you know, normally operating in our country.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about something I saw recently. It was in a Hill article about Shen Yun, which is, you know, the dance company that really advertises about 5,000 years of of a history in dance and China before communism is kind of the tagline here. I want to, it's kind of talking about something positive, but I know something's been happening with Shen Yun with respect to the Republic of China, like you're saying, about this spreading of disinformation and misinformation, specifically calling them an anti-society cult. So can you tell our audience a little bit, because here in the U.S., I'm very familiar with Shen Yun. I mean, they've recently performed here in Miami where I live, and I know probably our listeners have seen advertisements in their city for them. Can you kind of talk a little bit about what their the company does, the dance performance company does, and what their mission is?
The People's Republic of China, PRC, the Communist China, they have tried in every way to stop Shen Yun's performance all over the world. Now, Shen Yun, they have 8 companies touring all around the world every year. Every year, they reach out to more than 1 million audience. It's really a world-class show. Now, you know, what they perform is to give people the understanding and education what Chinese culture was prior to the communism. And people, audience, walk away from that show with an idea what China could be if without communist regime. So that's the biggest, threat, you know, the communist regime consider to its ruling power. So now they have trying to every way, you know, if you talk to a lot of venues that host Shen Yun before, they will tell you, you know, most of them will either receive phone calls or letters from the local Chinese embassy or the country's Chinese embassy or local Chinese consulate and threaten them to cancel the show. Not to let Shen Yun to use their venue. So this is kind of things going on ever since 2007. And I remember one scenario, 1 year that Shen Yun went to Australia to perform, and the Chinese ambassadors in Australia actually sent a letter to every single PM, every single member of parliament. And ask them not to go to Shen Yun's show. And, you know, as the result, after they send the letter, actually, most of the, you know, the parliament members show up in the show. I remember I saw the report. It was like make me laugh, because actually, while all these parliament members are sitting there waiting for the show to start, you know, one parliament member actually make a joke. He said, "Oh, hey, since we are all here, don't waste the time. Let's move forward and pass a couple bills here." So it's not really successful. The effort, but however, recently they have been, you know, Shen Yun, based on what we learned, that the New York Times, it's preparing a hit piece against the Shen Yun. You know, it seems like they're only interested in collecting the negative stories about Shen Yun. Now, you know, Shen Yun, it's a group kind of more or less related to Falun Gong, because Shen Yun started by a group of Falun Gong practitioners who came to United States because the persecution of Falun Gong, right? Now, that's how they started this performing group, because it's similar like, you know, the ballet dancers who left the Russia, you know, Soviet Union, came to United States for freedom. It's a kind of a similar story. And now, but in the past 25 years, the New York Times has been really doing the big favor to the Chinese communist regime. The majority of their stories related to the persecution against the Falun Gong, it's either contained the disinformation or misinterpretation of Falun Gong. And I remember in one case that the New York Times actually published a story. They interview a prisoner, a Falun Gong practitioner who are still in prison. And then they make a quote of that person who says, you know, the re-education camp in China is more comfortable than his own home. So that's kind of why you have like the persecution make millions of people lost their job. A lot of people die, broken families. And why you have the New York Times reporting, you know, say, oh, those people, you know, who practice Falun Gong and jailed by the Communist Party, who think that the re-education camp, it's more comfortable than their own home. So this is kind of a ridiculous report made by the New York Times in the past and, you know, and what they are working on right now.
You've been covering it for so long. You can go check out all of Nan's work over at the Epoch Times. Nan Soon, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast. Can't thank you enough. Continued success to you and please stay safe.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, that's our show. Our thank yous to Nan Soon, investigative reporter over at the Epoch Times. You can go read all of his articles about everything you just heard him talk about with respect to China and the U.S. and the relationship, why Taiwan is so important. You go to epictimes.com to read all about that. For our show, you want to watch the video portions of the interviews that we have done with people on this show, head over to our YouTube channel, type in Can We Please Talk Podcast. We should pop right up. Audio podcast platforms, you know by now, Apple, Spotify, Google. Shout out to everybody that listens to us over on Good Pods. Shout out to Acast, our hosting platform. Can't do it without them. Can't do it without each and every one of you that listens to this program. As always, I'm Mike Leon.
And I'm Nick Saverio.
We'll see everybody next time.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.